But Kitty felt and acted quite differently. When she saw the invalid, she pitied him, and that pity produced in her woman's soul not the horror and repulsion which it evoked in her husband, but a need for action, for finding out all the particulars of his condition, and a desire to help him. Those very details, the thought of which alone filled her husband with horror, at once arrested her attention. She sent for the doctor, sent to the chemists, made the maid she had brought with her help Maria Nikolaevna sweep, dust, and wash, and herself washed and scrubbed some articles and spread something under the blanket. At her command, things were brought in and taken out of the sick room. She herself went several times to their own room, and, without paying any attention to the people she met, brought back with her sheets, pillowcases, towels, and shirts. The waiter, who was serving a meal to some engineers in the drawing-room, came up several times at her summons with a cross look on his face, but could not help fulfilling her orders. She gave them with such kindly insistence that it was impossible to disobey her. Levin disapproved of all this, not believing that any good could come of it to the invalid. Above all, he was afraid that his brother might get angry about it. But the sick man, though apparently indifferent to it all, was not angry, but only ashamed, and on the whole appeared rather interested in what she was doing for him. When Levin opened the door on his return from the doctor's whither Kitty had sent him, he saw the invalid at the moment when, at Kitty's command, Maria Nikolaevna and the waiter were putting a clean shirt on him. The long, white skeleton back with the enormous shoulder blades and protruding ribs and vertebrae was bare, and Maria Nikolaevna, with the waiter's help, somehow got one of the shirt sleeves twisted and could not guide the long, limp arm into it. Kitty, having hurriedly shut the door behind Levin, was not looking that way, but the invalid moaned, and she came toward him. "Be quick," she said.
"Don't come here,"
muttered the sick man angrily.
"I can myself."
"What do you say?"
asked Maria Nikolaevna. But Kitty had heard, and understood that he felt embarrassed and uncomfortable at being stripped in her presence. "I'm not looking," she said, helping the arm in. "Maria Nikolaevna, you go round to the other side and put it right," she added. "There is a little bottle in my handbag," she went on, turning to her husband. "You know, in the side pocket. Please go and get it, and meanwhile everything will be put straight here." When Levin returned with the bottle, he found the invalid arranged in bed and everything around him quite altered. Instead of the foul smell, there was an odour of vinegar and of scent, which Kitty, pouting her lips and puffing out her rosy cheeks, was blowing through a little glass tube. There was no trace of dust left about. There was a mat beside the bed. On the table, medicine bottles and a bottle of water were neatly placed, also a pile of folded linen which would be required later, and Kitty's embroidery. On another table by the bedside were a glass of some refreshing drink and some powders. The invalid himself, washed and with his hair brushed, lay between clean sheets in a clean shirt, its white collar round his abnormally thin neck, gazing with a new look of hope at Kitty and not taking his eyes off her. The doctor whom Levin had fetched and whom he had found at a club was not the one who had hitherto attended Nikolai, with whom the patient was dissatisfied. The new doctor took out a stethoscope and sounded him, shook his head, prescribed some medicine, and gave extremely precise instructions about giving the medicine and about diet. He ordered raw or very lightly boiled eggs and seltzer water with new milk at a certain temperature. When the doctor had gone, the patient said something to his brother, of which Levin caught only the last words, "Your Kate." But by the look he gave her, Levin saw that his brother was praising her. He asked Kate, as he called her, to come nearer.
"I feel much better," he said. "Had I been with you, I should have recovered long ago. How pleasant."
He took her hand and drew it toward his lips, but as if fearful that this might be disagreeable to her, he changed his mind, let her hand drop, and merely stroked it. Kitty took his hand in both of hers and pressed it.
"Now turn me over on the left side and go to bed,"
he murmured. No one heard what he said, but Kitty understood him. She understood because her mind incessantly watched for his needs. "On the other side," she said to her husband. "He always sleeps on that side. Turn him over. It is unpleasant to call the servants, and I cannot do it. Can you?" she said, addressing Maria Nikolaevna.
"I am afraid to," answered Maria Nikolaevna.
Dreadful as it seemed to Levin to put his arms round that terrible body, to grasp those parts under the blanket which he did not wish to remember, yet submitting to his wife with that determined expression which she knew, he thrust his arms under the blanket, and despite his great strength was struck by the strange heaviness of those emaciated limbs. While he was turning him, with the enormous lean arm about his neck, Kitty quickly and unostentatiously turned and beat the pillow, and arranged the invalid's head and the hair that again clung to the temples. The patient retained his brother's hand in his. Levin felt that he wished to do something with his hand and was pulling at it, and yielded with a sinking heart. Yes, his brother drew the hand to his lips and kissed it. Levin, trembling, choking with sobs, and unable to utter a word, left the room. Chapter 19.
Thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes, thought Levin, while talking with his wife that night. He thought of the gospel text, not because he considered himself wise, he did not, but because he could not help knowing that he was more intelligent than his wife and Agafya Mikhailovna. He could not help knowing that when he thought about death, he thought with all the powers of his soul. He knew, too, that many great and virile minds whose thoughts on that subject he had read had pondered it, and yet did not know a hundredth part of what his wife and Agafya Mikhailovna knew on the subject. Different as were those two women, Agafya Mikhailovna and Kitty, or Kate, as Nikolai called her, and as Levin was also fond of calling her now, in that respect, they were exactly alike. Both knew with certainty what life was and what death was, and though they would have been quite unable not only to answer, but even to understand the questions which confronted Levin, neither doubted the importance of those phenomena, and they both had exactly the same outlook upon them, an outlook shared not only by them, but by millions of others. The proof that they knew surely what death was lay in the fact that they knew without a minute's hesitation how to behave with the dying, and did not fear them. But Levin and others, though they were able to say a great deal about death, evidently did not know anything, for they feared it and had no notion what to do when people were dying. Had Levin now been alone with his brother Nikolai, he would have looked at him with horror, and would have waited about in still greater horror, not knowing what to do next. More than that, he did not know what to say, how to look, or how to step. To talk of indifferent things seemed an affront, and he could not do it. To talk of death and dismal things was likewise impossible, and it was equally impossible to keep silent. "I fear that if I look at him, he will think I am watching. If I don't look, he will imagine I am thinking of something else. If I walk on tiptoe, he will be displeased, and yet I am ashamed to tread on the whole of my foot." But Kitty evidently did not think, and had no time to think of herself. She, prompted by some inner conviction, thought of him, and everything came out right. She talked to him about herself and about her wedding, smiled, sympathized, caressed him, mentioned cases of recovery, and it was all successful, so she evidently knew what she was about. The proof that her and Agafya Mikhailovna's behavior was not instinctive, animal, and unreasoning lay in the fact that they both demanded for the dying man something of greater importance than mere physical care, something that had nothing in common with physical conditions. Agafya Mikhailovna, speaking of the old man who had died, had said, "Well, God be thanked, he received communion and extreme unction. God grant everybody to die so."
Just in the same way, Kitty, besides all her cares about linen, bedsores, and cooling drinks, had managed on the very first day to persuade the invalid of the necessity of receiving communion and extreme unction. When Lievin returned to their two rooms for the night, he sat with hanging head, not knowing what to do. Not only could he not think of supper, of getting ready for the night, of considering what they were to do, he could not even talk to his wife. He was ashamed to. Kitty, on the contrary, was more active than usual, and even more animated. She ordered supper to be brought, unpacked their things herself, helped to make the beds, and did not forget to sprinkle insect powder on them. She was in that highly wrought state when the reasoning powers act with great rapidity, the state a man is in before a battle or a struggle, in danger, and at the decisive moments of life. Those moments when a man shows once for all what he is worth, that his past was not lived in vain, but was a preparation for these moments. All she did was well done. And before midnight, everything was sorted, clean, and neat, so that their apartments showed a resemblance to her own rooms at home, beds made, combs, brushes, and looking-glasses laid out, and covers spread. It seemed to Lievin that it would be inexcusable to eat, sleep, or even to talk, and he felt that his every movement was improper. She, however, sorted combs and brushes, and did it all in such a way that there was nothing offensive about it. However, they could not eat anything, nor sleep for a long time, and even did not go to bed till very late. "I am very glad I have persuaded him to receive extreme unction tomorrow," she said as she sat in her dressing jacket before her folding glass and combed her soft, fragrant hair with a small comb. "I have never been present, but Mama told me that there are prayers for the restoration of health." "Do you really think he can recover?" he asked, looking at the back of her round little head, at the narrow parting which closed every time she drew the comb forward. "I asked the doctor. He says he can't live more than 3 days. But how can they know?" "Still, I am very glad I persuaded him," she said, turning her eyes toward her husband from behind her hair. "Everything is possible," she added with the peculiar and rather cunning expression which always appeared on her face when she spoke of religious matters. Since their talk about religion during their engagement, neither he nor she had ever started a conversation on that subject. But she continued to observe the rites, went to church and prayed, always with the same quiet conviction that it was necessary to do so. In spite of his assurances to the contrary, she was persuaded that he was a Christian like and even better than herself, and that all he said about it was one of his funny male whims, like his sayings about her embroidery, that good people darn holes while she cut holes on purpose, and so on. "Yes, you see, that woman Maria Nikolaevna could not arrange all that," said Lievin. I must confess I am very glad you came. You are purity itself, and—" He took her hand and did not kiss it. To do so with death so near seemed to him unbecoming, but only pressed it, looking guiltily into her brightening eyes. "It would have been so painful for you alone," she said, and raising her arms high so that they hid her cheeks, now flushed with pleasure, she twisted her braided hair and pinned it up at the back of her head. "No," she continued, "she did not know how to. Luckily, I learnt a good deal in Soden."
"Can there have been such sick people there?"
"Oh, worse."
"It is so terrible to me that I cannot help seeing him as he was when young. You would not believe what a charming lad he was. And I did not understand him then."
"I quite believe it, quite.
I feel that we should have been friends, he and I,"
she said. And frightened at her own words, she glanced at her husband, and tears filled her eyes.
"Yes, would have been," he said sadly. He is really one of those of whom it is said,
they are not for this world. However, we have hard days before us. Let us go to bed, said Kitty, with a glance at her tiny watch.
Chapter 20 Death. Next day the patient received communion and extreme unction. During the ceremony he prayed fervently. In his large eyes, fixed upon an icon which had been placed on a little table covered with a coloured cloth, was a look of such passionate entreaty and hope that Lievin was frightened at seeing it. He knew that this passionate entreaty and hope would only make the parting from the life he so loved more difficult. Lievin knew his brother and the direction of his thoughts, knew that he had become a sceptic not because it was easier for him to live without faith, but because, step by step, modern scientific explanations of the phenomena of the universe had driven out his faith. He knew, therefore, that this return to the old faith was not legitimate, not a similar result of thought, but was only a temporary, selfish, and irrational hope of recovery. Lievin knew, too, that Kitty had strengthened that hope by tales of extraordinary recoveries of which she had heard. Knowing all this, Lievin suffered much as he saw that look full of entreaty and hope, that emaciated hand lifted with effort in making the sign of the cross to touch the drawn skin of the forehead, the protruding shoulder blades, and the hollow, hoarse chest which could no longer contain that life for which the invalid was praying. During the sacrament, Lievin did that which, agnostic though he was, he had done a thousand times before. He said, addressing himself to God, "If thou dost exist, heal this man. Such things have often happened, and thou wilt save both him and me." After receiving extreme unction, the invalid suddenly felt better. He did not cough once for a whole hour, smiled, kissed Kitty's hand, thanking her with tears in his eyes, and said he felt well, had no pain, but had an appetite and felt stronger. He even sat up when they brought him some soup, and asked for a cutlet too. Hopeless as his case was, obvious as it was that he could not recover, Lievin and Kitty were for that hour both in the same state of excitement, happy yet timid and fearful of being mistaken.
Better? Yes, much better. Wonderful! It is not at all wonderful. Still, he's better, they said in whispers, smiling at one another.
But this illusion did not last long. The invalid fell quietly asleep, but awoke half an hour later with a fit of coughing, and immediately every hope fled from those around him and from himself. The reality of his sufferings destroyed it, leaving no trace, nor even any recollection of the former hopes in Lievin, Kitty, or the patient himself. Not referring to what he had believed half an hour previously, as though he were ashamed to remember it, Nikolai told them to give him a bottle of iodine covered with perforated paper for inhaling. Lievin handed it to him, and at once the look of passionate hope with which the invalid had received extreme unction was fixed on his brother, demanding from him a confirmation of the doctor's words to the effect that inhaling iodine worked miracles.
"Kitty is not here?"
he asked hoarsely, glancing round when Lievin had reluctantly confirmed the doctor's statement.
"No, then I can tell you. It's for her sake I went through that comedy. She's such a dear. But you and I cannot deceive ourselves like that. Now, in this, I do believe,"
he said, clutching the bottle with his bony hand and beginning to inhale from it. Between 7 and 8 o'clock that evening, Lievin and his wife were drinking tea in their room when Maria Nikolaevna rushed in, breathless.
"He's dying," she whispered. "I'm afraid he'll die immediately."
Both ran to his room. He was sitting up with his long back bent, leaning his elbows on the bed and hanging his head.
"What do you feel?"
asked Lievin in a whisper, after a pause.
"I feel I am departing,"
uttered Nikolai with an effort, but very distinctly, as if he were pressing the words out of his body. He did not lift his head, but only turned up his eyes, failing to reach his brother's face.
"Kate, go away," he added.
Lievin jumped up and in a commanding whisper told her to leave the room.
"Departing,"
Nikolai repeated. "Why do you think that?" asked Lievin, in order to say something.
"Because I am departing,"
he repeated, as if that word pleased him.
"It's the end."
Maria Nikolaevna approached.
"You'd better lie down. You would feel easier," she said.
"I'll soon be lying,"
he said softly.
"Dead,"
he added cynically and angrily.
"Well, lay me down if you like."
Lievin laid his brother on his back, sat down beside him, and holding his breath, gazed at his face. The dying man lay with closed eyes, but at intervals the muscles of his forehead worked as if he were thinking deeply and intently. Lievin involuntarily meditated upon what was taking place within his brother at that moment, but in spite of all the efforts of his mind to follow, he saw by the expression of that calm, stern face and the play of the muscles above one eyebrow that something was becoming clear to the dying man, which for Lievin remained as dark as ever.
"That's so."
Slowly pausing between words, the dying man murmured,
"Wait a bit."
He was silent again.
"That's so,"
he drawled in a tone of relief, as if he had found a solution.
"Oh, God,"
he muttered with a heavy sigh. Maria Nikolaevna felt his feet.
"Growing cold,"
she whispered. For a very long time, as it seemed to Lievin, the invalid lay motionless, but he still lived and at long intervals sighed. Lievin was already wearied by the mental strain. He felt that despite all his mental efforts, he could not understand what was so and was already lagging far behind his dying brother. He was no longer able to reflect on the actual problem of death and could not hinder thoughts about what he would soon have to do. To close his brother's eyes, dress him, order a coffin. And strange to say, he felt quite cold and experienced neither joy nor grief, nor a sense of loss, still less of pity, for his brother. If he had any feeling left for him, it was more like envy of that knowledge which the dying man now possessed and which he might not share. For a long time he sat leaning over Nikolai, waiting for the end. But the end did not come. The door opened and Kitty appeared. Lievin rose to stop her, but at that moment he heard the dying man move.
"Don't go,"
said Nikolai, and stretched out his hand. Lievin gave him his hand, signing angrily with the other to his wife. With his brother's hand in his, Lievin sat half an hour, then an hour, and yet another hour. He now no longer thought about death at all. He was wondering what Kitty was doing, who lived in the next room, and whether the doctor had a house of his own. He wished to eat and sleep. Carefully disengaging his hand, he felt his brother's feet. They were cold, but he was still breathing. Lievin tried to go out on tiptoe, but the invalid moved again and said,
"Don't go!"
Day began to dawn, but the sick man's condition remained the same. Lievin gently disengaged his hand, and without looking at his brother, went to his own room and fell asleep. When he woke, instead of the news he expected, that his brother was dead, he heard that his former condition had returned. He again sat up, coughed, ate and talked, no longer of death, expressed hopes of recovery, and was even more irritable and depressed than before. No one, neither his brother nor Kitty, could comfort him. He was angry with everyone, said disagreeable things, blamed everybody for his sufferings, and demanded that they should fetch a celebrated doctor from Moscow. To all questions of how he felt, he gave the same answer with an angry and reproachful look.
"I am suffering terribly, intolerably."
The sick man suffered more and more, especially from bed sores, which would no longer heal, and he grew more and more irritable with those about him, particularly because they did not bring the doctor from Moscow. Kitty tried to help him and comfort him in every possible way, but it was all in vain, and Lievin saw that she herself was worn out physically and mentally, though she would not admit it. That consciousness of death which had been evoked in them all by his farewell to life on the night he had sent for his brother was destroyed. Everyone knew he would soon and inevitably die, that he was already half dead. Everyone wished that he would die quickly, and they all, concealing that feeling, brought him bottles of medicine, went to fetch medicines and doctors, and deceived him and themselves and one another. It was all a lie, a repulsive, insulting, blasphemous lie. And as a result of his character, and because he loved the dying man more than the others did, Lievin felt that lie most painfully. Lievin, who had long wished to reconcile his brothers, even if only at the moment of death, had written to Sergei Ivanich, and having received his answer, read it to Nikolai. Sergei Ivanich wrote that he could not come personally, but, in touching words, asked his brother's pardon. The invalid made no comment. "What am I to write to him?" asked Lievin. "I hope you are not angry with him."
"No, not at all,"
answered Nikolai, vexed at the question.
"Tell him to send me a doctor."
Another 3 days of torture went by. The sick man was still in the same condition. Everyone who saw him now desired his death. The waiters in the hotel, the proprietor, all the other visitors there, the doctor, Maria Nikolaevna, Lievin, and Kitty. Only the invalid himself did not show that desire, but on the contrary was angry because the doctor had not been fetched, and he continued taking medicine and talking of life. Only at rare moments, when opium made him forget his incessant sufferings for a moment, did he sometimes, when half asleep, express what was stronger in his soul than in any of the others.
"Oh, if only it were over."
Or,
"When will this end?"
His sufferings, regularly increasing, did their work of preparing him for death. There was no position that did not cause him pain, no moments of forgetfulness, no part of his body that did not hurt and torment him. Even the memories, impressions, and thoughts within his body now aroused in him the same sort of repulsion as the body itself. The sight of other persons, their words, his own recollections, gave him nothing but pain. Those about him felt this, and unconsciously did not permit themselves either to move freely, talk, or express their own wishes in his presence. His life was quite swallowed up in a consciousness of suffering and a desire to be released from it. It was clear the change was taking place within him which would bring him to regard death as a fulfillment of his desires, as happiness. Formerly, every separate desire caused by suffering or privation, such as hunger or thirst, was relieved by some bodily action which brought enjoyment. But now privation and suffering were not followed by relief, but the attempt to obtain relief occasioned fresh suffering. Therefore, all his desires were merged into one, a desire to be released from all this pain and from its source, his body. He had no words to express his desire for this liberation, and therefore did not speak of it, but went on from habit demanding satisfaction of those wishes that could be fulfilled.
"Turn me on the other side," he said,
and immediately afterwards asked to be put back as he had been.
"Give me some beef tea. Take it away. Tell me something. Why don't you speak?"
Then as soon as they began to talk, he shut his eyes and expressed weariness, indifference, and disgust. On the 10th day after their arrival in that town, Kitty fell ill. She had a headache, was sick, and could not leave her bed all the morning. The doctor explained her illness as the result of fatigue and agitation, and ordered mental tranquility. After dinner, however, Kitty got up and went as usual to the sick man, taking her embroidery. Nikolai looked at her sternly when she entered, and smiled contemptuously when she said she had been ill. That day he continually blew his nose and moaned piteously. "How do you feel?" she asked him.
"Worse,"
he answered with an effort.
"It
Where does it hurt?"
"Everywhere."
"Today it will end. You'll see," said Maria Nikolaevna in a whisper, but so that the invalid, whose senses were very acute, was, as Levin saw, sure to hear her.
Levin said, "Hush," and turned to look at his brother. Nikolai had heard, but the words had no effect on him. His look remained reproachful and strained.
"Why do you think so?" Levin asked when she had followed him into the corridor.
"He has begun to clutch at himself," replied Maria Nikolaevna.
"Clutch? How?"
"Like this," she said, pulling at the folds of her stuff dress.
And Levin noticed that all day long the sick man really kept catching at himself, as if wishing to pull something off. Maria Nikolaevna's prophecy was fulfilled. Toward night the patient could no longer raise his hands, and only gazed straight before him without changing the attentive, concentrated expression of his eyes. Even when his brother or Kitty bent over him so that he could see them, he did not look at them. Kitty sent for the priest to read the prayers for the dying. While the priest read, the dying man showed no sign of life. His eyes were closed. Levin, Kitty, and Maria Nikolaevna stood by the bedside. The prayers were not yet ended when the dying man stretched himself, sighed, and opened his eyes. Having finished the prayer, the priest touched the cold forehead with his cross, which he then wrapped in his stole, and after standing in silence another 2 minutes, touched the enormous, bloodless hand which was growing cold.
"He has passed away," said the priest, and turned to go.
But suddenly the clammy moustache of the dying man moved, and from the depth of his chest through the stillness came his voice, sharp and distinct.
Not quite. Soon.
A moment later, his face brightened. A smile appeared under the moustache. And the women who had gathered round him began zealously to lay out the body. The sight of his brother and the proximity of death renewed in Lievin's soul that feeling of horror at the inscrutability, nearness, and inevitability of death which had seized him on that autumn evening when his brother had arrived in the country. That feeling was now stronger even than before. He felt even less able than before to understand the meaning of death, and its inevitability appeared yet more terrible to him. But now, thanks to his wife's presence, that feeling did not drive him to despair. In spite of death, he felt the necessity of living and loving. He felt that love had saved him from despair, and that love under the menace of despair grew still stronger and purer. Scarcely had the unexplained mystery of death been enacted before his eyes, when another mystery, just as inexplicable, presented itself, calling to love and life. The doctor confirmed their supposition about Kitty. Her illness was pregnancy. Chapter 21. From the moment that Karenin understood from his conversations with Betsy and Oblonsky that all that was asked of him was that he should leave his wife in peace and not trouble her with his presence, and that his wife herself wished this, he felt so lost that he could decide nothing for himself, did not know what he now wanted, and having placed himself in the hands of those who with so much pleasure busied themselves with his affairs, he consented to everything. Only after Anna had left his house and the English governess sent to ask him whether she was to dine with him or alone, did he for the first time clearly understand his position. And he was horror-struck at it. What was most painful in his situation was his inability to reconcile his past life with the present state of things. It was not the past when he lived happily with his wife that perplexed him. The transition from the past to the consciousness of his wife's infidelity he had already painfully passed through. That had been trying, but it was comprehensible. Had his wife then, after confessing her infidelity, left him, he would have been grieved and unhappy, but he would not have felt himself to be in such an unintelligible impasse as now. He could not at all reconcile his recent forgiveness, his emotion and love for his sick wife and for another man's baby, with the present position, with the fact that, as if in reward for all that, he was now left alone, disgraced, ridiculed, not wanted by anyone and despised by all. The first 2 days after his wife's departure, Karenin received petitioners and his private secretary, attended committee meetings, and went to the dining room to dinner as usual. Without rendering account to himself why he did it, during those 2 days he tried with all his might to appear calm and even indifferent. When answering questions as to what should be done with Anna's rooms and belongings, he made the greatest efforts to seem like a man by whom what had taken place had not been unforeseen, and who did not consider it extraordinary. In this he succeeded. No one could have observed in him any signs of despair. But on the third day, when Cornet brought him a bill from a firm of milliners which Anna had forgotten to pay, and informed him that the shopman had come in person, he had him brought in.
"Excuse me, Your Excellency, for taking the liberty of troubling you, but if you wish us to address ourselves to Her Excellency, please be so good as to let us have her address."
Karenin appeared to be considering, when suddenly he turned round and sat down at the table. Dropping his head on his hands, he sat thus for a long time, tried several times to speak, but stopped short. Comprehending his master's emotion, Corneille asked the assistant to come again another time. Karenin, left alone, realized that he could not any longer maintain an appearance of firmness and calm. He ordered the carriage that was waiting to be unharnessed, said that he would receive no one, and did not appear at dinner. He felt that he could not bear the general pressure of contempt and harshness which he had clearly seen in the faces of that shop assistant and of Corneille, and of everyone without exception whom he had met during those 2 days. He felt that he could not divert from himself people's hatred, because that hatred was caused not by his badness — had it been so, he might have tried to be better — but by his disgraceful and repulsive misery. He knew that for that reason, because his heart was rent in pieces, they would be pitiless toward him. He felt that people would destroy him, as dogs kill a tortured dog that is whining with pain. He knew that the only way of escape from men was to hide his wounds from them. He had unconsciously tried to do so for 2 days, and now felt himself unable to continue the unequal struggle. His despair was heightened by the consciousness that he was quite alone in his sorrow. Not only was there not a soul in Petersburg to whom he could express what he felt, who would pity him, not as a high official, not as a member of society, but simply as a suffering human being. But nowhere at all had he any such friends. Karenin had been left an orphan. There were 2 of them. He had a brother. They could not remember their father, and their mother died when Alexei Alexandrovich was 10 years old. They had small means. Their uncle, Karenin, a high official and at one time a favourite with the late emperor, brought them up. Having taken a medal on finishing, both at school and at the university, Karenin, by his uncle's help, started at once on a conspicuous path in the civil service, and from that time devoted himself entirely to official ambition. Neither at school, nor at the university, nor afterwards in the service, did he enter into friendly relations with anyone. His brother was nearest to his heart, but he served under the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and always lived abroad, where he died soon after Alexei Alexandrovich's marriage. At the time when he was governor of a province, Anna's aunt, a rich provincial lady, introduced him, who, though not a young man, was a young governor, to her niece, and contrived to put him in such a position that he was obliged either to propose or leave the town. Karenin hesitated long. At that time there was many reasons for the step as against it, but there was no such decisive reason as to make him neglect his rule of refraining when in doubt. But Anna's aunt intimated to him through an acquaintance that he had already compromised the girl, and that he was in honour bound to propose to her. He proposed, and devoted to his betrothed and to his wife all the feeling of which he was capable. His attachment to Anna excluded from his soul any need he had felt for affectionate relations with other persons, and now among all his acquaintances he had no intimate friend. He was connected with many people, but had friendly relations with none. He knew many persons whom he could invite to dinner, could ask to take part in anything he was interested in, or to use their influence for some petitioner, and with whom he could frankly discuss the actions of other men and of the government. But his relations with these persons were confined to a sphere strictly limited by custom and habit from which it was impossible to escape. There was a fellow student of the university with whom he had subsequently become friendly, and to whom he might have spoken of his grief, but that fellow student was now curator in a distant educational district. Of the Petersburg people, the most intimate and most likely were the doctor and Mikhail Vasilich Sliudin, his private secretary. Sliudin was an unaffected, intelligent, kindly, and moral man who, Karenin felt, had a personal liking for himself. But their 5 years' official activity together had built a barrier in the way of any intimate talk between them. Once Karenin, having finished signing documents, remained silent a long time, glancing now and then at Mikhail Vasilich, and tried several times but was unable to begin speaking. He had prepared a phrase.
"You have heard of my misfortune?"
But it ended by his saying merely the usual,
"Then you will get this ready for me?"
and letting him go. The other person, the doctor, was also well inclined toward Karenin, but they had long ago come to a tacit understanding that they were both overwhelmed with work and had no time to spare. Of his women friends, including the principal one among them, the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, Karenin did not think at all. All women, as such, appeared to him dreadful and repulsive. Chapter 22. Karenin had forgotten the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, but she had not forgotten him. At that most painful time of lonely despair, she came to his house and entered his study unannounced. She found him in the posture in which he had long sat, resting his head on his hands.
"J'ai forcé la consigne," she said as she entered with hurried steps, breathing heavily from her rapid movement and from excitement. "I have heard everything. Alexei Alexandrovich, my dear friend," she continued, firmly clasping his hand in both hers and gazing with her beautiful, dreamy eyes into his.
Karenin rose, frowning, and disengaging his hand, moved a chair toward her.
"If you please, Countess, I do not receive, because I am ill," he said, and his lips trembled.
"My dear friend,"
repeated the Countess, with her eyes fixed on him. And suddenly the inner corners of her eyebrows rose, forming a triangle on her forehead, and her plain yellow face grew still plainer. But Karenin felt that she was sorry for him and ready to cry. He was moved, and seizing her plump hand, began kissing it.
"My dear friend,"
she repeated in a voice broken by emotion,
"you must not give way to sorrow. Your sorrow is great, but you will find consolation."
"I am broken. I am stricken. I am no longer a man," said Karenin, releasing her hand, but continuing to gaze into her tearful eyes. "My position is terrible, because I cannot find support anywhere. I cannot find it even in myself."
"You will find support.
Do not seek it in me, though I want you to believe in my friendship," she replied, with a sigh. "Love is the only support, that love which he has bequeathed us. His yoke is easy," she went on with that ecstatic look he knew so well. "He will support you and help you."
Though it was evident that she was touched by her own lofty sentiments, and though her words proceeded from that new ecstatic, mystic influence which had lately spread through Petersburg and which Karenin had considered superfluous, it was pleasant to him to hear them now.
"I am weak. I am done for. I did not foresee it, and don't understand it now."
"My dear friend,"
Lydia Ivanovna said once more. "It is not the loss of what no longer exists. It is not that," continued Karenin. "I don't regret that. But I cannot help feeling ashamed before others of the position I am in. That is wrong, but I can't help it. I can't."
"It is not you who have performed that great act of forgiveness which fills me and everybody else with rapture, but he that dwells within your heart," said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, turning up her eyes ecstatically. "And therefore you must not be ashamed of your action."
Karenin frowned, and bending his hands backward, began cracking his fingers. "One must know all the details," he said in a high-pitched voice. "Human strength has its limits, Countess, and I have reached the limits of mine. All day long I have had to take domestic decisions resulting from—" he emphasized the word resulting, "my new solitary position. The servants, the governess, the bills.
These petty flames have burnt me, and I was unable to bear it. At dinner yesterday, I very nearly left the table. I could not bear the way my son looked at me. He did not ask me the meaning of it all, but he wanted to ask, and I could not endure his look. He was afraid of looking at me.
But this is not all.
Karenin was going to mention the bill that had been brought him, but his voice shook, and he paused. He could not think of that bill made out on blue paper for a bonnet and ribbons without pitying himself.
I understand, dear friend, said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. I understand it all.
Not in me will you find help and consolation, though I have come to help you if I can.
If I could take all those trivial, humiliating cares off your shoulders! I see that a woman's word, a woman's direction, is wanted.
Will you entrust it to me?
Karenin silently and gratefully pressed her hand.
We will look after Seretse together.
I am not good in practical matters. Still, I will undertake it. I will be your housekeeper. Do not thank me.
I am not doing it of myself.
I cannot help thanking you.
But, my dear friend, do not give way to that feeling you were speaking about, of being ashamed of that which is the utmost height of Christianity. He that humbleth himself shall be exalted, and you must not thank me. You must thank him and ask him for help. In him alone you will find peace, comfort, salvation, and love.
And raising her eyes to heaven, she began to pray, as Karenin understood from her silence. Karenin listened to her now, and those very expressions which formerly had seemed to him, if not disagreeable, at least superfluous, now seemed natural and comforting. He did not like that new ecstatic influence. He was a believer, interested in religion chiefly from a political point of view, and this new teaching which allowed itself some novel interpretation just because it paved the way for disputes and analyses was repugnant to him on principle. He had formerly regarded the new teaching with coldness and even hostility, and had never discussed it with the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, who was carried away by it, but had carefully and silently evaded her challenges. Now, for the first time, he listened to her words with pleasure and without mental rejoinder.
I am very, very grateful to you, both for your actions and your words, said he when she had finished praying.
The Countess Lydia Ivanovna once more pressed both the hands of her friend.
Now I am going to act, she said,
smiling and wiping the traces of tears from her face.
I am going to see Seretse.
Only in extreme cases will I apply to you.
And she rose and went out. The Countess went to Seretse's part of the house, and there, watering the frightened boy's cheeks with her tears, told him that his father was a saint, and that his mother was dead. The Countess kept her word. She really took upon herself the care of arranging and managing Karenin's household, but she had not exaggerated when she said she was not good at practical matters. None of her directions could be carried out without alteration, and the alterations were made by Karenin's valet, Korney, who now imperceptibly directed the whole household. Quietly and tactfully, while helping his master dress, he would inform him of anything that was necessary. But nevertheless, Lydia Ivanovna's help was in the highest degree effective, for it gave Karenin the moral support of the consciousness of her affection and respect, and especially of the fact that she had nearly converted him to Christianity, as it consoled her to believe. That is to say, she had changed him from an apathetic, indolent believer into a fervent and firm adherent of that new interpretation of the Christian teaching which had lately spread in Petersburg. For Karenin it was easy to accept that interpretation. Like Lydia Ivanovna and others who shared these views, Karenin was quite devoid of that deep, imaginative faculty of the soul by which ideas aroused by the imagination become so vivid that they must be brought into conformity with other ideas and with reality. He saw nothing impossible or incongruous in the notion that death which exists for the unbeliever did not exist for him, and that as he possessed complete faith, of the measure of which he himself was the judge, there was no longer any sin in his soul, and he already experienced complete salvation here on earth. It is true that the frivolity and falseness of this view of his faith were vaguely felt by Karenin. He knew that when, without thinking that his forgiveness was the act of a higher power, he had surrendered to his faith, he had experienced more joy than when, as now, he was perpetually thinking that Christ lived in his soul, and that while signing documents he was fulfilling his will. But it was absolutely necessary for Karenin to think thus. It was so necessary for him in his humiliation to possess at least this imaginary exaltation, from the height of which he, the despised of all, was able to despise others, that he clung to this mock salvation as if it were the real thing. Chapter 23. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna, when quite a young and ecstatic girl, was married to a rich, aristocratic, very good-natured, and most jovial profligate. About 2 months after their marriage, her husband left her, and only answered her ecstatic assurances of tenderness with ridicule and even with animosity, which those who knew the Count's good nature and who saw no fault in the ecstatic Lydia were quite unable to explain. Since then, though not divorced, they lived apart, and when the husband did meet his wife, he always treated her with an unchanging, venomous irony which seemed inexplicable. The Countess Lydia had long ago ceased to be in love with her husband, but since then had never ceased to be in love with somebody else. She was in love with several persons at once, both men and women. She had been in love with almost everyone who was specially notable. She was in love with all the new princes and princesses who became connected with the imperial family. She was in love with a metropolitan, a suffragan, and a priest. She had been in love with a journalist, three Slavs, Komissarov, one of the ministers, a doctor, an English missionary, and now with Karenin. All these passions, ever waxing or waning, did not interfere with her carrying on very widespread and complicated relations with the court and society. But from the time she took Karenin under her special protection after his misfortune, from the time she exerted herself in his house, laboring for his welfare, she felt that all her other passions were unreal, and that she now truly loved only Karenin. The feeling she now had for him seemed to her stronger than any of her former sentiments. Analyzing that feeling and comparing it with her previous loves, she saw clearly that she would not have been in love with Komissarov had he not saved the Tsar's life, nor with Ristik Kudzitsky but for the Slavonic question, but that she loved Karenin for himself, for his lofty, misunderstood soul, for the high-pitched tone of his voice with the long-drawn inflections which she thought charming, for his weary eyes, for his character, and for his soft hands with their swollen veins. She was not only glad to meet him, but searched his face for signs of the impression she created on him. She wished to please him not merely by words, but by her whole self. For his sake she now paid more attention to her dress than ever before. She caught herself meditating on what might have been had she not married, and had he been free. She blushed with excitement when he entered the room, and could not repress a smile of delight when he said something agreeable to her. For some days the Countess Lydia Ivanovna had been greatly excited. She had heard that Anna and Vronsky were in Petersburg.
It was necessary to save Karenin from meeting her, necessary even to save him from the painful knowledge that that dreadful woman was in the same town with him, and that he might come across her at any moment. Lydia Ivanovna found out through acquaintances what those disgusting people, as she called Anna and Vronsky, intended to do, and tried so to direct her friend's steps during those days that he should not meet them. A young adjutant, a comrade,